What's the 411? You tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens, their families, communities, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield. 2 weeks before his college graduation, Kelly Klink's younger brother Matt hanged himself. The news came as a shock, and it sent Kelly into a spiral of grief and guilt. Kelly Klink's new memoir, A Different Kind of Same, traces Kelly's journey through guilt and grief, her investigation into her own role that depression played in her brother's death, and ultimately her path toward acceptance, forgiveness, resilience, and love. Kelly, welcome to 411 Teen.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you and have you share your information. It can be so helpful. Can you tell us a little bit about your own family background, just to provide some perspective, please?
Sure. So my brother and I, we grew up in the Detroit area. My parents were also from there, so our whole extended family lived there. And then when I was 15 and my brother was 12, we moved from Detroit to Alabama for my dad's work. So that was a big change, and we both, you know, really struggled with that. And that's when the depression started for me. And a few years later, that's when my brother was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. So, you know, those teenage years moving and trying to settle down in a new place, that's where, you know, things really started to come to light, difficulties with mental illness.
Okay. What is the significance of the title, A Different Kind of Same?
Yeah, so, you know, to me, I think that's what siblings are in mm-hmm. general. You know, where you're different, but you're coming from the same people. You're coming from the same experience. You know, my brother and I were not too different in age, and you know, we really we shared a lot. He was my only sibling, so it was just the two of us. And then on, you know, another level, we both experienced mental illness, and we had, you know, similar experiences attempting suicide in our teen years, taking medication, going to psychologists and psychiatrists, being hospitalized. But ultimately, what I found after he died was that our experiences were very different, and we were very different people. So we had that similarity, but, you know, we were also very different.
Can you share the differences or some of the differences that you have identified and become aware of?
So one of them is that I was diagnosed with depression and my brother was diagnosed with bipolar. When those diagnoses happened, we were both really young, and, you know, I didn't understand how depression was different from bipolar.
Mm-hmm.
I just sort of thought, oh, they're just, it's the same thing that, you know, happened with me. They're just giving it another name. Obviously, when I got older and in my adulthood, you know, I've done research, I've met other people with bipolar disorder, and I see how very different it is, cycle mm-hmm. like that, through depression and then into the mania and, you know, those difficult states in between. The medications used to treat it are different. My brother and I didn't talk about this, but I would imagine that the therapy, you know, the talk therapy used to treat it is different. I think some of the other differences that are maybe less apparent on the surface, or just that personality-wise, I was someone who was a lot more motivated to ask for help and share my feelings. And, you know, even though I was afraid of being rejected, I was also just so desperate that I really, you know, I couldn't hold it all in. Whereas I think my brother was very private. He was very shy. He did not want to share what was going on with him. And I think, you know, it weighed on him so much that he just came to a place where he was unable to continue carrying that burden, but also didn't feel like he could reach out.
Mm-hmm. Why did you write the book, the memoir?
So there were several reasons. I think on a personal level, writing has always been therapeutic for me. Even when I was a teenager and was first diagnosed with depression, writing was something I did that that was a place where I felt safe. I felt safe sharing my feelings, and sort of always helped me work through my feelings. And so after my brother died and I was grieving, you know, grief is really can be very overwhelming. It can be very messy. It's complicated. You have a lot of feelings. You're angry. You're sad. You're, you know, jealous. Mm-hmm. Who knows? I mean, there's just so much. And the only way I could really get through that was to write. But the only way I could sort of make sense and understand my experience. Mm-hmm. So it was definitely, you know, therapeutic. And I needed that to help me understand what had happened to my brother and what he had been going through. And also what had happened to me and what I was going through. I also wanted to tell our story because I thought it would help other people. I wanted other survivors of suicide to know that they weren't alone, that their healing was possible, and that, you know, there are so many different ways to experience this loss, and none of them are wrong. I also wanted people who hadn't lost anyone to suicide, but maybe knew someone who had, or, you know, even didn't know anybody, just the general public, that they would know, hey, this is what it's like. Just, you know, this is what it's like when you lose someone to suicide. And that way, if you encounter someone who's had that loss, maybe you've got some empathy and compassion for them. And then another group that I wanted to sort of touch was just people living with mental illness, because the book isn't just about me losing my brother. It's also about me coming to terms with my own depression and my own experience with mental illness and sort of figuring out how to live fully with that, and that's possible. Your mental illness doesn't have to be an enemy. It's not a weakness.
Nor does it have to define you. Would you agree? I was going to say no. Nor does it have to define you.
Yeah, absolutely. I want people living with the mental illness to know that, and I want the general public to know that too. And probably the third reason that I wrote the book was just to get people talking. Suicide and mental illness are topics that, you know, people have kind of shied away from for a long time. They've been taboo, I guess. And I think the more we can talk about them, the better, you know, treatment people will have, the less people will be discriminated against, and the more lives we'll save.
In your family, how was mental health issues and the mental health illness that you have and your brother had, how was that handled? How was it addressed? Was it talked about at all? Or was there a lot of emphasis placed on keeping it a secret?
Yeah, I mean, it was, it was not talked about very much. I think my parents are very young, and so they, I think at the time that I was, gosh, this is scary to think about, at the time I was diagnosed with depression, they were the age I am now.
Oh, okay.
So they were very young, and I think they just wanted us to be okay. They just wanted us to be okay. So it was like, okay, we'll do what the doctors say. You'll go to therapy. You'll take your mm-hmm. medication. Mm-hmm. And it kind of stopped there. It didn't really become a family discussion or, you know, and there was never any overt, like, don't tell anybody what's mm-hmm. going on
okay.
with you.
Okay, okay.
But because we never talked about it, I think, I don't know how my brother felt, but I know I was, you know, I was embarrassed. I was afraid that kids at school would find out that I had attempted suicide, that I had been in the hospital, that I was on medication. I didn't really tell anyone.
Well, what about, I'm thinking about extended family, grandparents, cousins, where, of course, you had moved, I guess, from the family, the central family location to Alabama. So I guess you could easily just go your on with your daily responsibilities and others didn't know. I'm just wondering how that you maneuvered and no one knowing in the family.
I think, yeah, we were removed.
Mm-hmm.
I think my parents did tell the extended family. But again, it just wasn't something that anyone was talking about. I think what happened was I got the feeling that they were afraid that talking about it or bringing a lot of attention to it might make it worse. Like, are we going to make her feel worse? If we don't just treat her like nothing's wrong, is she going to feel, you know, we should just keep treating her like nothing's wrong? And I think what I really craved, actually, was someone to say, wow, you're going through some really serious stuff, and that's okay.
So it would have been helpful, what I hear you saying, is to be, you know, forthright with it and talk about it. And that would have helped you to have a better understanding of what's happening.
Yeah, I think it's really important for anyone of any age, you know, if they're going through something, that it needs to be acknowledged.
You tuned in to 411 Teen. We're going to take a brief break. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens and their families and their communities and other interested folks. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and this hour I'm talking with Kelly Klink. Kelly has written a memoir, A Different Kind of Sane. Kelly, I had to interrupt you, but you were just talking about how the need to talk and to express what was going on, you think really would have been a benefit?
Yes, I think it's really important to acknowledge when somebody is experiencing a struggle or something difficult. You don't have to try and fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where maybe it's difficult for parents because, of course, you don't want your children to suffer. You want to do whatever you can to help them. But sometimes the biggest help is just to say, wow, you're suffering, and I'm here for you, and it's okay. It's okay that you're suffering. We don't have to, you know, I'm not going to have to try and fix that for you. I'm going to let you, you know, be where you are, and I'm mm-hmm. just going to be here with you.
So a validation, so to speak, of what you are experiencing, what you're going through, would have been fine, is what I hear you saying.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Was there a strong stigma about mental illness where you were at that time? I mean, what was going on that way?
So this was, you know, about 20 years ago.
Okay.
And I do think things have changed, but I do think there still is.
Oh, yes.
Stigma, yeah, for mm-hmm. sure. And I think, you know, I just remember being very sensitive, and, you know, anytime I would show emotion or feel like I was, you know, having maybe an episode of depression, I would worry so much that somebody would point it out and say, oh, she's crazy. Like, don't, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I experienced any stigma directly, but I think it was because I kept everything so hidden.
Okay. Well, how did you cope? Given that here you are, you've been diagnosed with depression and are in therapy and taking medication. Your younger brother is diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and he's taking medication and going to therapy. How did you cope? What did you do?
Well, I did see a therapist, and that was very helpful. She was wonderful, my therapist that I had when I was in high school. And I think for me, the things that were most helpful were art. I did a lot of painting and drawing, and just mm-hmm. anytime I could do something with my hands and create something, it was very peaceful. You know, I could live in the moment, and I think that's one of the best ways to deal with depression is, you know, if you can do something that just sort of like gets you in the moment, gets you out of that head spinning, you know, where you're thinking about, mm-hmm. oh, I feel terrible, I'm going to feel like this forever, you get in that loop. If you can just stop that, just take one pause, and art really did that for me. Writing was another. I did a lot of writing, and sports. I loved sports. I played soccer. I like to run. So sports were great. They also really helped me to just make friends and be around people. I think that's also so important. It's kind of for me anyway, it was always my first instinct to isolate myself when I wasn't doing well. And, you know, if you can surround yourself with people, particularly people who are not going to judge you, who are going to, you know, let you be yourself, that's just a great support network.
What about your academic school performance? How was that affected? Or was it affected at all?
It was affected. I had some problems. Around the time I was diagnosed with depression and began treatment was actually this summer. So I had a couple of months there to kind of right the ship, I guess, mm-hmm. would be a cliche for it. But going into that next school year, though, I was still struggling, and my grades were not that great, and for the most part, had some sympathetic teachers, and I do believe my parents were honest with them about what was going on with me. I would also guess that, as, you know, seasoned educators, they could probably tell that I was struggling. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them were, you know, let me complete assignments because I was actually hospitalized for a while that mm-hmm. semester. I had lots of time to make up work. I also did have at least one instructor who was not so sympathetic, and you know, my parents had to kind of push really hard and speak to the principal and be like, look, here's the situation, you know, please, I think you should let her make up these exams that she missed and this homework that she missed. And I was able eventually to catch up on everything, you know, schoolwork. At that time, at least it felt like something I could do, you know. It didn't feel so insurmountable in the face of everything. It felt like something I could accomplish. It was something that I always enjoyed before, and it was something that I felt, you know, capable of. So I was able to catch back up, but it was difficult.
Did you and your brother ever discuss what you both were experiencing. You both had mental illness. You had many similarities that you have identified. Did you talk about what you were experiencing, what was happening, your mental illness?
You know, strangely enough, we did not speak very much about that. And I, you know, it was something that after he died, I thought, gosh, why? Why didn't we talk about that more? And I think part of it might have just been that, you know, for me anyway, I didn't want it to be happening. I just wanted to be normal. And when he, you know, a couple of years after I was diagnosed and hospitalized, then when he started going through it, I was angry at him. Mm. Like, you know, oh, we've already been through all this and it was so hard on the family. I was kind of viewing it as something he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you doing this to us? And it really wasn't until after he died, I think it was before that, but it wasn't until we were more into our adulthood that I was able to see, okay, no, this was not just him acting out, you know, this was mm-hmm. an actual illness that he was experiencing, and I was able to have some more compassion for him, but he was also just a very private person, and, you know, I think he was much more honest with his friends about what he was feeling and experiencing than he was with my parents and I,
mm-hmm.
and, but there were a few times that we did talk about things, and I mentioned that in the book. There's one instance where he was right around the time that he attempted, he was extremely depressed and feeling terrible about himself and feeling like he was a terrible person, and he was crying. And that's the last time, one of the only times I'd ever seen him cry.
You attempted suicide, and then you wrote and have spoken that later your brother attempted suicide. Did you feel responsible for his attempt? Did you feel like he was modeling you, emulating you?
I felt horrible when he attempted that first time, and his attempt was nearly identical to mine, and I really felt like it had happened because of me. And I still wonder. I know that there's, you know, contagion
mm-hmm.
studies, and I know that there are lots of studies in family psychology that show that older siblings have a large influence on younger siblings, in some cases even larger than the parents have on the younger children.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, I felt very guilty, and that was something that he and I didn't talk about either. And certainly I wish that we had. I wish that I had spoken to him about that. But yeah, I do still feel guilty about it. I'm not sure that I'll ever stop.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know eventually in the book, you know, that you came to a conclusion that even though you felt like you were the blame for your brother's suicide, that you can help only those who want to be helped. Do you still hold that position?
I do. I believe that, you know, there's only so much you can do for someone who doesn't want to accept your help,
mm-hmm.
Or who isn't even asking for it. My brother, at the time of his death, was not telling my parents and I that he was having suicidal thoughts or feelings. We spoke to him regularly on a weekly basis. He was away at college. And I spoke to him earlier that week, and he didn't mention anything. There was nothing he said that was a red flag to me. So there was, you know, he wasn't asking for help from us.
Mm-hmm.
I do believe that, you know, it's important to ask other people. Now, at the time, that wasn't something I thought about, but of course now I think, well, if you know that somebody is maybe in a stressful situation, like my brother was about to graduate from college, and this is a person who lives with a mental illness or has, you know, expressed suicidal ideation in the past, it's not out of bounds to ask someone, how are you doing? Are you feeling suicidal? Are you feeling overwhelmed? But at the same time, if they tell you, no, I'm fine, which my parents did ask him, actually, regularly, how he was doing and whether he was depressed. If someone keeps telling you that they're fine.
And they're away, distant.
And they're away, and they're an adult.
And they're an adult.
Yeah.
There's not too much you can do.
There's really not, which is unfortunate. But there are still so many things you can do. And I think, you know, just continuing to reach out to someone.
Exactly.
Continuing to offer your support. Continuing to engage them in real talk about their feelings and their struggles. You know, that's...
Exactly.
That's going to at least let somebody know that you're there, and that way, if they are ready to ask for help, they'll be able to trust you and know that you're there for them.
Kelly, what role, if any, did religion play in your overall household, in your home? How did religion define your family's behaviors and possibly their attitudes?
So I grew up in a very Catholic household.
Okay.
My mother at the time was very devout, and we went to church every Sunday. We went to religious education once a week, and for her, religion had been like a relief, I guess. It was her coping. That's what she used. She had maybe a kind of a difficult childhood as well, and she had always found peace with religion. That was not the case for me nor my brother. We both really struggled with, you know, how devout our mother was, and there was this kind of expectation that we would feel the same way about religion that she did, and that it would provide the same kind of balm for us, and it just didn't. There was this sort of pressure within religion to feel that if you know, could connect with God, then everything would be okay and all would be healed, and I just didn't experience it that way, and neither did he. Since then, in my adulthood, you know, I've been able to sort of see a much more expansive view of spirituality and what it can do for people. And, you know, that just because one maybe religion, like the religion that you were raised in, doesn't sort of feed your soul, doesn't mean that there's not something else out there for you, doesn't mean that God won't speak to you through a different path, and that there can be solace and support and help in spirituality. And also there doesn't have to be, and that's okay too.
A Different Kind of Sane, a memoir by Kelly Klink. Kelly, where does one get this book? Where do they go? It's on Amazon. What else?
Well, it's on Amazon. I think it's on sale for like $12. It's a bargain.
Okay.
And I think probably local independent bookstores.
Okay. All right. As we talk about suicide, and you have your firsthand experience, you're a survivor of suicide, you've attempted suicide yourself, what do you feel one should know about suicide attempts? What is the message for those who have had, you know, teens and young folks who have attempted suicide? What would you tell them?
Well, I would definitely say there's nothing wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with having thoughts of suicide. There's nothing wrong with having depression. There's nothing wrong with having attempted suicide. I would say it's really scary to talk about. You might be afraid that people won't understand, and they might not. But that doesn't mean that they won't love you and that they won't support you. It's okay if your life doesn't feel the same anymore after. Your life, you're always going to feel different. Things are going to change. And the main thing that I would say is it gets better. I mean, life just gets so much better. The older I get, the more I learn, the more comfortable I become with myself, the more I learn about my depression, the more comfortable I become with my depression. It's just so great, and I'm so glad I didn't die.
Well, I appreciate you sharing all of this information with us. It's very helpful, my listening audience. It's very enlightening, very insightful, and I know it may have been therapeutic, but I'm sure it was also difficult for you to do. My listening audience, you're tuned in to 411 Teen. This hour, we're talking about surviving suicide. Joining me from Chicago, Illinois, is Kelly Klink. Her new memoir, she explores the suicide of her younger brother, Matt. The book is A Different Kind of Same. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you. ...41,149 Americans took their lives in 2013, the most recent year for which full data is available. It's the country's 10th leading cause of death. Suicide rates vary significantly among demographic groups and in different geographic regions. A variety of factors, individual, interpersonal, environmental, increase the vulnerability to suicide. You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens, their families, communities, and other interested folks. This hour, I'm talking with Kelly Klink. Kelly's new memoir explores the suicide of her younger brother, Matt, and investigates into the role her own depression played in her brother's death. Ultimately, we see her path toward acceptance, forgiveness, resilience, and love. Kelly, we've talked about what folks need to know, need to be aware of with suicide and depression. What are the things they need to do? You've said if you suspect someone is depressed, ask them. And I thought that was very powerful because a lot of times individuals are uncomfortable with asking. Would you elaborate on that a little bit more?
It's definitely a difficult question to ask. It's very personal. I think we, you know, because of the stigma, we worry that someone might feel judged. We don't want to make someone feel uncomfortable. I think that's the biggest thing, right?
Yes.
You don't want to make someone feel uncomfortable, but the truth is, the uncomfortable conversations are the ones that are going to help someone the most. So you're probably going to feel a little uncomfortable. They're probably going to feel a little uncomfortable. But at the end of the conversation, you're probably both going to feel a lot better, regardless of, you know, whether the person is depressed or not. Just the fact that you are reaching out and that you care, and the fact that they know, hey, I can talk to this person, I can share some, you know, deep, real feelings with them. You're building a bridge for someone, and you're building a bridge for yourself.
Well, we know what we need to do. Are there things that you could share? Are there behaviors, comments that you could share with us that we really are, it's important for us not to do. It's important to avoid, if possible, that really may exacerbate that feeling of depression.
Definitely. So I would say if somebody tells you that they're feeling depressed or you suspect that someone's depressed, please don't tell them to just cheer up.
You'll be okay.
Everything will be fine.
You're right.
I think, you know, that's the message that people get in, from society. And that's the message that makes it so hard for someone to ask for help because they think, well, I'm supposed to be handling this all by myself. Nobody wants to hear about my problem.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, definitely don't tell somebody to suck it up or deal with it on their own. I would say, just in general, don't ever tell somebody how to feel. If somebody tells you, I'm really nervous about this job interview tomorrow, don't say, don't be nervous. Just say, well, yeah, that's normal. I get nervous before that kind of stuff, too. I bet you'll do great.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody tells you they're afraid, just validate that. Validate it. I would also say, if somebody is confiding in you or you suspect that somebody is depressed, don't write it off. Don't say, well, I'll give them a couple of weeks and see what they're like then. See if they'll get through it on their own. You want to make sure that you reach out when you notice it. You want to make sure that if they confide in you, that they're having suicidal thoughts, that you talk to the appropriate people, their family members or somebody, you know, who can help them. You don't just want to ignore the situation and hope that it improves on its own because that's dangerous. And you may miss a chance to save someone's life.
What about the friend that says to you, yes, I am feeling suicidal. I just don't know what to do. I mean, life doesn't matter anymore. But listen, don't say anything to anyone. This is just between you and me. And I know that has happened on a number of occasions. How should that friend deal with that?
That is a difficult situation. And I think personally in that respect, in that situation, that's a time when it's okay to break your friend's confidence. I think you need to talk to someone, a counselor, a teacher, one of your parents, one of your friend's parents. If you're older, you know, and your friend is married, you know, speak with your friend's spouse. And I don't think you do that behind your friend's back. I think you say, look, I honestly feel like we need to talk to someone about this. I can't just keep this to myself because I care about you, and I want to do what I can to help you. And I know it's scary. I know you don't want me to tell anyone, but I think this will help, and I think we should talk to somebody together.
So you're talking about keeping secrets, just saying that keeping secrets is not, we can't do this. It does not work. You're concerned, and, you know, again, validating them, reassuring them that it can be addressed. Whatever they are experiencing can be addressed.
Yeah, and I think offering, you know, to be there with them when they talk to someone could be really helpful as well because, again, it's really scary to, you know, if you're a teenager to tell your parents, you know, hey, I'm not doing well. I'm thinking about hurting myself. That's the prospect of telling your parents that. I mean, I never told my parents that. I just tried to kill myself. So I think, you know, if somebody could be there with you and say, look, let's do this together, you know, then you're not alone, and there's, you know, you've got someone there to just hold your hand. So if you can do that for your friend, I think that's amazing.
Did you find that you were guarded and that you mistrust people?
In my teen years or now?
No, when in your teen years, when you were experiencing.
Okay. Yeah, I think after I moved, I really struggled because I didn't know anyone, right? So all my friends were new friends. I didn't know them that well. I wasn't sure how they would react if they knew these things about me. Adults, even after I moved, the dynamics between adults and younger, you know, children and teens it's different in different regions. And I didn't sort of have that code of respect and manners that is prevalent in the South. And I always got the feeling that, you know, adults were, they thought I was very disrespectful. And I mean, I know now that I was, not intentionally, but I didn't know any better. So I had a very hard time connecting with people and feeling like it was safe for me to be honest about what I was going through and to ask for help.
The death of your brother had to send you into a whirlwind. How did you handle that sense of loss?
It was very overwhelming. It was the worst thing that's ever happened to me. And for probably the first 2 years after he died, I was just shattered. I quit my job. I tried to get another job. I quit that job. I tried to get another job. I quit that job. I wasn't sleeping. I wasn't, you know, taking care of myself physically. I isolated myself from friends. I fell into a really deep depression, and I continued. I found a special therapist, a therapist who specialized in grief and suicide loss, and I joined a support group. And I also tried different medications, but really, ultimately, I just needed to sort of live through the grief. There's no way around. You can only go through. And you know, I think writing was what saved me. Because I couldn't talk about it at that point. Once I started writing about it, it was probably 3 or 4 years after I started writing about it, was when I could finally talk about it with my husband and my parents. And then after that, my friends, I started feeling like I could talk about not only my brother, but also me and my depression and everything that I had been through. Because in writing about it, I was starting to see the damage that all that silence had done, the damage it had done to him and the damage that it had done to me.
For the listening audience, would you share some of the warning signs that may be all around us that we tend to overlook or not value? Can you share some of the warning signs of possible suicide thoughts? And
yes. So if you notice that someone you care about is maybe giving away possessions, that's a big warning sign. If you see if somebody that you care about is really isolating themselves, they don't want to go out anymore, they don't want to talk to anyone, that's a warning sign. If they certainly are speaking at all about harming themselves, or if they're just saying things like, you know, this is all meaningless, you know, this is pointless, life is pointless, I have nothing to live for, that's another warning sign. I would say if they're behaving very differently than they usually would, maybe doing risky things, or suddenly they don't care about things that they once cared about very deeply, that's a warning sign. Those are the ones I can think of off the top of my head.
Those are fine. Ultimately, you did reach a path of acceptance and forgiveness, resilience. How does one develop resilience? How do you get there? How do you get to resilience and acceptance and forgiveness? In these last few minutes, we have about 4 or 5 minutes. Would you share that for those who want to get there?
I think it is surrender.
Okay.
I think surrender is the key. Once you stop trying to change the way you feel, once you stop trying to change your circumstances,
mm-hmm.
once you stop trying to change whatever it is that happened, the horrible, horrible thing that you wish didn't happen, it did happen,
mm-hmm.
and once you can just, you know, grieve and let yourself grieve and, you know, let yourself feel however you feel, that's your first step to, you know, to coming back and to living. And also to know resilience and surrender are things that you practice on a daily basis. It's not like, okay, you get through this one thing and then everything's going to be okay again. Mm-hmm. Life is hard. You're going to have losses. You're going to have challenges. You're going to get knocked down a lot, and you're going to have to get back up. And, you know, I think what's great is that once you've done it a couple times and you know you can do it, that's then you're going to be able to do it again the next time.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to, each time you live through something, live through a challenge, you're going to come out with more compassion, more a bigger heart, and just, you know, hopefully a stronger will to live and to love.
What role do you find that knowledge and information play in your getting to this point of acceptance and forgiveness and resilience? Because I would think that if you have a better understanding of just the dynamics and what is going on, that would help you to reach some level of acceptance.
Absolutely. I think doing as much digging as I could do into my brother's life, learning what I could learn about bipolar disorder, learning what I could learn about depression, learning what I could learn about just family dynamics and faith, everything, you know, that I've learned, and especially all the people that I met along mm-hmm. the way, friends of my brothers, other survivors, it just, you know, fueled all of this desire and really helped me to get to that place of surrender, and continues to help me get to that place of surrender, because once you get there, you have to keep looking for it. It moves around.
Yeah, and I'm glad you said that, because my next question was, once you get there, don't you have to keep working at it?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep, every day. You got to keep looking every day. But it gets easier to find, and every time you find it, you kind of laugh and smile a little bit and go, oh, yeah, there it is.
Mm-hmm. What about resources in this last minute? Are there resources you would share with a listening audience, with their families, communities, with young students, young folks? Any resources that you would share that you found to be very beneficial?
Yeah, there's definitely Crisis Text Line is the latest thing I've heard about, and it's
mm-hmm.
Something that young people can, it's like a hotline. And you can only, it's texting, which is great. I think, you know, social media is also becoming more geared towards helping people. AFSP.org, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, has tons of resources. They do lots of great stuff, walks, programs.
Before we close, any words of wisdom?
Don't take it too seriously. You know, don't take it all too seriously, and ask for help. There's no shame. Ask for help.
All right. Well, thanks so much. That's it for this edition of 411 Teen. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. This edition of 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical assistant, Ken Smith. Audio copies are available, and if you want to participate in 411 Teen or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. If you would like to subscribe to 411 Teen podcast, log in wfsu.org. Check us out on Facebook.